3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 37, the N1L3 complex. While NASA was achieving one first after another in manned spaceflight with the first five Gemini missions, Gemini 3, 4, 5, and 7-6, the Soviet Union was starting to focus on their own manned lunar landing mission. As I explained back in episode 27, the Soviet Council of Ministers and the Central Committee of the Communist Party issued decrees supporting a manned lunar landing effort under Sergei Korolev's direction back in June 1964. Korolev then became distracted by having to launch the Voshod 1 mission in October 1964, followed by the Voshod 2 mission in March 1965. For the rest of 1965, however, he would not launch another manned mission and would be able to focus more on the Soviet lunar landing effort. Korolev's plan for landing a cosmonaut on the moon had two major components: the N1 rocket and the L3 spacecraft. Together known as the N1L3 complex, this was Korolev's vehicle for landing a cosmonaut on the moon. Today, I'm going to talk about the development of the two constituent components of the N1L3 complex. Starting first with the N1 rocket. Now, I've already talked about the N1 rocket quite a bit back in episode 23, so I'm just going to give a brief recap here. I'll also caveat that the development history of the N1 is a bit confusing. A lot of the sources I have seen are rather contradictory. In part, that's because the design of the N1 rocket morphed quite a bit over time, and the sources don't always specify what time period they're talking about when they describe the N1 rocket. In brief, the N1 rocket, as initially proposed in early 1962, was a heavy-lift rocket capable of launching 40 tons into low Earth orbit. Almost immediately, however, Korolev revised the N1 rocket to increase its lift capability to somewhere between 75 and 80 tons. In this configuration, the N1 rocket's first stage was to use 24 NK-15 engines. These NK-15 engines were named after the rocket engine designer responsible for building them, Nikolai Kuznetsov. Kuznetsov was that former jet engine engineer who Korolev brought in to build his rocket engines when he couldn't get along with the famed rocket engine designer, Valentin Glushko. Although Korolev had prepared the technical documents for the manufacture of the N1 rocket by sometime in 1963, the manufacture of the rocket was not underway. Despite official government decrees authorizing the development and construction of the N1 rocket, the Ministry of Defense had very little interest in such a rocket. As a result, Korolev received substantially fewer funds than needed to actually build the rocket. By March 1964, all work on the N1 was basically frozen. But then in June 1964, the Soviet government approved Korolev's plan for a Soviet lunar landing effort. This revived the fortunes of the N1 rocket. The N1 rocket now had an official purpose: to get a Soviet cosmonaut to the surface of the moon. But the N1 rocket, as designed at the time, was not sufficiently powerful enough for this mission. This was due in large part to Korolev's decision to change the mission profile he originally had for landing on the moon. In Korolev's early conceptions for missions to the moon, he had always relied upon Earth Orbital Rendezvous, or EOR. The plan was to launch multiple N1 rockets to construct a single spacecraft complex in Earth orbit that would then journey to the moon. But after the Soviet government approved his plans for a manned lunar landing, he changed the mission profile from Earth Orbital Rendezvous to Lunar Orbital Rendezvous. This decision was likely to match NASA's decision to rely on Lunar Orbital Rendezvous after a lengthy debate. The decision to use Lunar Orbital Rendezvous, however, meant that a single N1 rocket now had to carry a spacecraft, a lunar lander, and a rocket stage sufficient to launch this spacecraft complex toward the moon and back. Of course, NASA faced the same problem, but NASA was planning to use the Saturn V rocket, which was designed to lift about 130 tons into Earth orbit. By contrast, at the time, the N1 rocket was designed to lift only 75 to 80 tons. The first order of business, then, was to redesign the N1 rocket. By December 1964, Korolev signed off on a draft plan for upgrading the N1. The first stage of the uprated booster would now have 30 NK-15 engines, up from the 24 NK-15 engines in the previous design. In total, this would allow the N1 rocket to lift about 95 to 100 tons into low Earth orbit. This was substantially less than the Saturn V rocket, but it made a Lunar Orbital Rendezvous mission profile more plausible. But plausible was only barely so. Initial estimates suggested that the lightest the L3 spacecraft could be made was about 95 tons. Eventually, Korolev's engineers got the L3 spacecraft to weigh about 93 tons, but that did not leave much room for error at all. In addition, by late 1964 and early 1965, Korolev's N1 rocket faced three challenges from rival engineers. One challenge was from Vladimir Chelemy, another from Valentin Glushko, and the final one from Mikhail Yangel. The first threat from Vladimir Chelemy I touched upon back in episode 27 when I discussed the N1 rocket in more depth. Basically, in August 1964, just 2 months after the government approved Korolev's lunar landing program, and by implication the N1 rocket, Chelemy pitched the idea to use his UR-700 rocket instead to land on the moon. Premier Nikita Khrushchev agreed to consider Chelemy's proposal and issued orders to establish a commission that would compare the N1 rocket and the UR-700 rocket and then decide which should be used for a lunar landing effort. Although Chelemy's UR-700 proposal did not result in the cancellation of the N1 rocket, it did strain already limited financial resources by forcing the parallel development of two heavy lift rocket programs. The funding strain also hit the N1 program at a critical time. Investments were needed immediately in 1964 into things like new test stands and manufacturing rigs that would impact the timeline for testing and the subsequent development and manufacture of the N1 rocket. To better understand this, remember way back in episode 12, I talked about all the things that NASA did after President Kennedy gave his State of the Union address, starting the space race back in May 1961. Within just a few months of that speech, before the end of the year, NASA was already acquiring the new launch site at Cape Canaveral to launch the massive Saturn V rocket. They were building the Vehicle Assembly Building, the largest building in the world by volume at the time, to assemble the Saturn V. NASA also acquired a new rocket manufacturing plant in New Orleans. NASA also acquired 54 square kilometers in the middle of nowhere in southwestern Mississippi to build a massive new rocket stand to test the engines for the Saturn V rocket. These were all the kinds of things that Sergei Korolev needed in 1964 for his N1 rocket. But the limited financial resources, exacerbated by the parallel development of Chelemy's UR-700 rocket, meant this did not happen. The second threat to the N1 rocket came from Valentin Glushko. Glushko criticized the proposed use of 30 NK-15 engines for the N1 rocket's first stage. As I mentioned back in episode 23 when I discussed the N1 rocket in more depth, the use of so many engines will cause significant problems. To balance this number of engines, the N1 rocket had to rely on the CORD system, or K-O-R-D, standing for Control of Rocket Engine System. If there was a problem with one of the NK-15 engines, the CORD system was to shut off the engine that was diametrically opposite of the engine that was failing. This would balance the thrust of the rocket overall. But the CORD system meant that the loss of one engine would actually mean by default a loss of a minimum of two engines, compounding any further problems. The system was also, by its nature, reactive and not predictive, so the N1 rocket could be far off course before the CORD system kicked in to correct its trajectory. Glushko proposed that the N1 rocket uses RD-270 rocket engine instead of the NK-15 engines. The RD-270 engine would be 4 times more powerful than the NK-15. The RD-270 would use unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide as its propellants, making the RD-270 the most powerful rocket engine ever using storable propellants. Using the RD-270 engines instead of the NK-15 engines would significantly simplify the first stage of the N1 rocket. Fewer engines would be necessary, so the rocket would not be dependent on the questionable CORD system to synchronize 30 NK-15 engines. Glushko was so confident in the RD-270 rocket engine that he began a political campaign to replace the NK-15 with the RD-270 for the N1 rocket. A problem with his proposal, however, was that he'd actually been working on the RD-270 engines since 1962, and he hadn't made significant progress on the engines by 1965. In the end, Korolev succeeded in defeating Glushko's push to use the RD-270. But Glushko would go on to offer the RD-270 engines to Chelemy, who would then go on to incorporate them into his proposed UR-700 rocket, the rocket that Chalamy was using to challenge Korolev's N1 program. Ironically, this course of events with Glushko was basically a repeat of the events from 1959, which kicked off the feud between Glushko and Korolev in the first place. Back then, Glushko was trying to convince Korolev to use a rocket engine that also used unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine as one of the propellants. Korolev refused, so Glushko tried to have another rocket engine designer, Mikhail Yangel, use those engines instead to design another ICBM. By offering the engines to Yangel, however, Glushko was in essence contributing to a challenge to Korolev's, at the time, monopoly over ICBMs in the Soviet missile industry, thus kicking off their feud. The third threat to the N1 rocket program came from that last rocket designer, Mikhail Yangel. Although the challenge from Yangel wasn't actually intentional. Basically, Korolev had proposed a rocket known as the GR-1 to the military. The GR-1 was to be used as part of a fractional orbital bombardment system. The important part for our story is that the engines for the GR-1 rocket were similar to the engines that were to be used on the upper stages of the N1 rocket. Thus, Korolev was relying on the GR-1 program to provide the necessary funds to develop a key part of the N1 rocket. In August 1964, however, Yangel successfully launched the R-36 rocket. The R-36 was designed to serve as a fractional orbital bombardment system, the same role as Korolev's proposed GR-1 rocket. As a result, the Soviet military canceled the GR-1 program in mid-1965. This left Korolev without the means to test the upper stages of the N1 rocket. So that was where things stood in 1965 with the N1 portion of the lunar landing program. Things were developing, but under constant threat from other programs, mainly Chalamy's UR-700 proposal, and the N1 program remained severely underfunded. The second part of the lunar landing program was the L-3 spacecraft. The L-3 spacecraft was actually two spacecraft because of the decision to go with Lunar Orbital Rendezvous. Similar to the Apollo program, one spacecraft would stay in lunar orbit as the mothership, while a second spacecraft would be the lunar lander to bring a cosmonaut to the surface of the moon. The mothership that would stay in lunar orbit was derived from the Soyuz spacecraft. Specifically, this Soyuz was known as the Soyuz 7K-LOK. The Soyuz 7K was the name of the original Soyuz spacecraft that Korolev planned to use for a circumlunar flight back in 1962, which I described in episode 15 on the origins of Soyuz. The LOK added to the name stood for Lunar Orbital Craft, so this was going to be the Soyuz Lunar Orbital Craft. The Lunar Lander spacecraft would be known as the LK, which simply stood for Lunar Craft. The design for the LK spacecraft bears a rather strikingly, if superficial, resemblance to the Apollo lunar lander. Like the Apollo lander, the LK lunar lander would have four legs and additional landing gear to prevent from capsizing if the spacecraft landed on the slope. But whereas the Apollo lunar lander had two engines, one for descent and one for ascent, the LK would only have a single engine for both descent and ascent. The use of a single engine on the LK spacecraft had been dictated by weight limitations. This engine would need to be throttleable, and because it was the only engine available on the LK spacecraft, it had to be highly reliable. In fact, the LK spacecraft sacrificed quite a few capabilities due to weight limitations. Overall, the LK was limited to 5.5 tons, even using the uprated N1 rocket. Compare this to the Apollo lunar lander, which was nearly 3 times heavier at 15 tons. These weight constraints also meant that the entire L3 complex would only carry 2 cosmonauts, and only one of the 2 cosmonauts would land on the moon's surface in the LK spacecraft. By contrast, Apollo would have 3 astronauts, 2 of whom would land on the moon's surface. This was not the only significant limitation on the L3 spacecraft due to weight. In order for the 1 cosmonaut assigned to the surface landing mission to get to the LK lander, the cosmonaut had to conduct a spacewalk from the Soyuz 7K-LOK to the LK lander. There was no docking module connecting the Soyuz and the LK that would permit a cosmonaut to go from one spacecraft to the other. A docking module that permitted a cosmonaut to transfer internally from one spacecraft to the other added too much weight onto the L3 complex for the N1 booster to carry. As a result, just to get from one spacecraft to the other, the cosmonauts would have to do a spacewalk. Korolev and his engineers reasoned that this spacewalk was not a big deal because the cosmonaut had to perform a spacewalk anyway on the surface of the moon. So adding 2 more spacewalks, one to get from the Soyuz to the LK, and another to get back, was not going to add all that much more risk or complexity to the mission. But this was probably wishful thinking. As I will discuss when we get to the remaining Gemini missions, NASA will soon learn that conducting an EVA is actually much harder than anyone thought. So overall, the mission profile would proceed as follows. An N1 rocket would deliver the L3 spacecraft complex to Earth orbit. The L3 complex would stay in Earth orbit for the first 24 hours to finish checking out the systems. The L3 complex would then fire its engines for translunar injection. 4 days later, the complex would approach the moon and conduct a retro burn to enter lunar orbit. The orbit would then be narrowed to try to make the landing easier. The cosmonauts would then depressurize the cabin of the Soyuz 7K-LOK spacecraft. The commander of the mission would then open the hatch and transfer to the LK spacecraft through a spacewalk. The engineer of the mission would remain in the Soyuz to assist if needed. The commander will then check the systems of the LK spacecraft. If all systems checked out, He will then separate and land on the moon. After landing, he will depressurize the LK spacecraft's cabin and then exit to walk on the moon's surface. The maximum time on the moon was limited to about 1.5 hours to 6 hours. The commander would then re-enter the LK spacecraft and lift off from the lunar surface. Once in orbit, the Soyuz 7K LOK will take the active role in docking with the LK spacecraft. Once docked, the commander will then perform a third spacewalk to go from the LK spacecraft back to the Soyuz LOK. Meanwhile, remember, now he has to drag with him any moon rocks that he brought from the moon. Once the commander got back into the Soyuz LOK, the LK would then be jettisoned, and the Soyuz LOK would fire its engines and return to Earth. Approaching the Earth at high speed, the Soyuz LOK will perform re-entry to the Earth by skipping off the Earth's atmosphere once before going for re-entry. That skip will help reduce the spacecraft's velocity before conducting re-entry. If this mission profile sounds a bit complicated and risky to you, you are not the only one. Korolev encountered resistance to this mission plan from virtually everyone. His own engineers doubted that the plan could actually be carried out. But Korolev did not tolerate a lot of opposition. There's one anecdote of an engineer who was transferred far away from the project after openly questioning the plan. The opposition to the mission profile became so intense that Korolev eventually bowed to some of the pressure by establishing a commission of external experts to provide an independent opinion. Included within this commission was Korolev's friend, the president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, Mstislav Keldysh. In July 1965, the commission rendered its opinion, and it was bad for Korolev. The commission thought that all systems had been pushed to their engineering limits to make the lunar landing mission possible. There was no room for error in many of the steps. Even Keldysh thought Korolev's plan was crazy. In particular, Keldysh thought that sending a single cosmonaut to the moon's surface would likely cause that cosmonaut to suffer from a mental breakdown. Korolev, however, was headstrong, and he basically bullied the commission into eventually providing some sort of tacit approval for the overall plan. Korolev's timeline for the N1 L3 program then was to complete all technical documents by August 1965, which would then allow manufacturing to begin. He then planned to begin flight testing in late 1966. To describe it generously, this plan was probably optimistic. The reality was that with the funding constraints on the development of the N1, the draft technical documents were still not complete by the end of 1965. The lunar landing program, however, is not the only manned lunar exploration program that the Soviet Union has. There was also the manned circumlunar flight program. This had originally been assigned to Korolev under the Soyuz program in 1962. In August 1964, however, the government gave Korolev the lunar landing program, and then reassigned the Circumlunar Flight Program to Chelemy, putting Korolev's Soyuz program in limbo. But Korolev was not about to take this lying down. So more about the Soyuz program next time.